I'm Michael Green, the clerk of Green's List, and I'm here to introduce to you Kath McCarthy, who is our presenter this morning. As you know, this morning covers the professional skills point that's needed in your CPD. The title from Kath is Are You Being Heard? A Revision of Core Communication Skills for Lawyers. You may ask, what does Kath know about communication skills for lawyers? Well, for most of her professional life, in fact, Kath has been a lawyer. She was a partner in a mid-level firm doing personal injuries work. She was also a manager with the Victorian Work Cover Authority. But about 18 months ago or so, 2 years, Kath decided to use her other skill and qualification, which is as a psychologist, to start her own coaching and training business. And hence this morning Kath brings to us both an intimate knowledge of the law, having been a practising lawyer for 15 years?
18
years. And also throughout that time having obtained a master's degree in psychology, and having started up her own psychology practice with a particular emphasis on coaching and training. And hence Kath brings both those skills to us this morning. So please welcome Kath McCarthy.
Thanks, Michael. Lawyers are pretty good communicators. Communication skills are the foundation of being an effective lawyer. It's no good knowing a lot about law if you can't hear and receive instructions, interact, give advice. So we're pretty good at it. But what we know doesn't always translate into what we do. As I look around the room, I see a lot of experience, particularly in the first row, Barry. A lot of experience, and by this stage of your career and your lives, you will have laid down patterns of communicating. You will have a style, you will have habits. When was the last time you spent an hour reflecting on those habits? When was the last time you changed one thing about the way you communicated to make you more effective in your practices? Today I'm going to pull apart the concept of communication to remind you what you already know and invite you to revisit communication with fresher eyes and invite you to reflect on your communication practices, particularly the way you send out messages and the way you receive them. It's going to be very basic stuff, but profound, I hope. Before I do, to set the scene, I'm going to go for a little trip down memory lane, which I really enjoy preparing for you, and you'll see why.
Will you keep quiet, Sebastian?
Excuse me, please.
Sebastian, please. Don't interrupt my act. Sebastian!
Well, Mr. Borders, I didn't see the lights there. I forgot about them.
What in the world are you doing? Why interrupt my act like this?
Well, look, Mr. Borders, I mean, after all, if you're in a ballpark, they always sell peanuts and popcorns and things like that.
I know that, Sebastian, but not in front of them. I beg your pardon, friend.
Ladies and gentlemen, and also the children, will you excuse me for a minute, please?
Thank you. What do you want to do?
Look, Mr. Borders.
What are you doing?
I love baseball.
Well, we all love baseball.
When we get to St. Louis, will you tell me the guys' names on the team so I go to see them in that St. Louis ballpark? I'll be able to know those fellas.
Well, now, is it all right, folks? All right.
Excuse me, I want to find out the fellas' names.
As long as it's okay with the audience.
I'm crazy about baseball.
Will you stand still? Pick up your hat. Go pick up your hat.
Okay.
Now, look. Then you'll go and peddle your popcorn and don't interrupt the act anymore?
Yes, sir.
All right. But you know, strange may seem, they give ball players nowadays very peculiar names.
Funny names?
Nicknames, pet names.
Not as funny as my name, Sebastian Dinwiddie.
Oh, yes.
Funnier than that?
Oh, absolutely. Woo! Yes. Now, on the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellas on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
You know the fellas' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean the fellas' name on first base.
Who?
The fella playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you who is on first.
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman on first?
Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Absolutely.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Why not? The man's entitled to it.
Who is?
Yes.
So who gets it?
Why shouldn't he? Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. After all, the man earns it.
Who does?
Absolutely.
Well, all I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, no. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy.
What's the guy's name on first base?
What's the guy's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Stay off of first, will you?
Well, what do you want me to do?
Now, what's the guy's name on third base?
Well, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Well, I can't change their names.
Will you please stay on third base, Mr. Broadhurst?
Now, what is it you want to know?
What is the fella's name on third base?
What is the fella's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know. Third base. You got an outfield?
Oh, sure.
St. Louis has got a good outfield?
Absolutely.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
Stay out of the infield.
Don't mention their names out here.
I want to know what's the fella's name in left field.
What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base.
Take it easy. Take it easy, man.
And the left fielder's name?
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's center field. He's center.
So I think that demonstrates just how frustrating it can be when you have something you want to say that's so clear to you and yet you're not heard. And if you're heard, you're not understood. We can relate to that. Messages we send out aren't injections of meaning. You know, a message has to be interpreted by the person we're sending it to. Of course we know that, but how often do we forget that? People put meanings into the messages we send. The messages we send don't put meanings into people. Now, I told Michael I was going to stand up here today and be very entertaining and just tell you all about communication. He said, well, that sounds boring. So I'm going to invite you to turn to the person next to you because I want you to introduce yourself to them. There's going to be 3 points in this presentation. We're going to pause for 60 seconds. 3 minutes and 3 minutes, so don't worry, no role plays, nothing like that. Turn to the person next to you and introduce yourself because you'll be coming back to that person 3 more times this morning. I'll give you 30 seconds. Communicate. Okay. Hopefully by now you've found a partner for the day, for the morning. Let's just look at the mechanics of communication. I chose a very simple diagram to remind us of how simple conceptually communication is. We form a thought, we decide on whether we're going to use words, what words we're going to use, whether we're going to write it, whether we're going to speak it, what kind of body language we're going to assume. We send it out. It's perceived by somebody else, heard or seen, and then they interpret that. And then there's a feedback loop. So simple, yet so often it goes wrong. And today I want to talk about 3 interferences in the communication process that is often seen in workplaces, and illegal workplaces too. Distractions, so simple, so often forgotten. Transient emotional states, emotional reactions, how people are feeling at that particular time when you're speaking to them, the impact that can have on the effectiveness of communication. And what I think is an umbrella concept, but the beliefs and the expectation and the worldview that someone brings to the communication process, both as a speaker and as a listener. It can have a profound effect on the effectiveness of communicating. To start with, distractions. Does this look like you without the beard? When you say something to a colleague, a client, a workmate, do you have his or her attention? Do they have yours? I don't know about you, but I spend a fair amount of time being a slave to my iPod, iPhone. It beeps at me and I obediently answer it, or at least tune into it for that second. When I was in private practice, I could be on the phone to someone, be writing a file note, be gesturing to my secretary out my window, potentially be signing mail with my left hand. I could be doing 100 things and still believing that I was paying attention to what was going on at the phone call. Distractions are a major source of communication breakdown. And we often assume that we can do all this stuff, even if we can multitask effectively and still maintain the necessary focus in order to communicate. Does what you're doing in the meeting with your clients or your colleagues in terms of writing or gesturing to your secretary or inviting them in for coffee at a critical moment, does that distract them? And it's not just external distractions. Internal distractions like preoccupations play a major role in people's capacity to focus on what you're saying. My sister-in-law, her mum died in one of the car accidents on the Calder over the long weekend. And we found out on the Monday night. And on the Tuesday, I spent the day in meetings and coaching. And the number of times those thoughts about the funeral logistics and how Tara was feeling sort of popped into my head during the day. People wouldn't have known how hard it was to remain focused. I had to keep bringing my attention back to what was going on because I was preoccupied. And it's not something I could control. It just popped into my head. When you're speaking to someone, what kind of assumptions do you make about their capacity to focus on what you're saying? They might be looking at you. Do you assume because they're looking at you, they're actually paying attention to you? So to counter the risk or to mitigate against the risk of someone not giving you their full attention, even though they're looking at you, a very easy technique, besides minimising distractions like this, a very easy technique is to spend 30 seconds before you speak to them to try to think about what is relevant in what you say to that person. So you frame your message in a way of how does this impact on them? What can they do about what you're about to say? Why should they care about what you're about to say? Because the studies show that people do focus their attention if what you're saying is directly relevant to you. It makes sense, doesn't it? But so often we say what we think we need to say without thinking of how is someone listening to this. So a simple technique. Temporary emotional states, emotional reactions, are a significant interruption to effective communication. Moods affect communication. If someone's in a bad mood, they will listen to what you say but tune in to anything negative in what you say more than you would expect. So when someone's in a bad mood, so there's negative emotion like anxiety, sadness, depression, and even stress, they will tend to focus in and tune in to negative aspects of communications more so than if someone is excited, happy, curious, positive emotions. They will give more weight to what's positive. If you're speaking to someone like a client who is stressed, do you anticipate that what they're going to be listening to is the worst case scenario in anything you say? Because they will be. They will tend, they can't help it, they'll tend to tune in to what's the worst of what you're saying. So those sort of mood factors are something you need to be aware of and counter when you're speaking to somebody. But other emotional states play their role. Those sort of strong emotions like anger and sadness and anxiety that come and go during the day rather than a mood that permeates more than one day. To explain how this works, I'm going to take you on a very quick, simple tour of the brain. The neocortex of the brain, the top part of the brain, is unique to humans. And it's where our logic and our reasoning comes from most of the time. It's a bit simplistic because there's interactions. Emotions are regulated by a deeper part of the brain, an older part of the brain. And when emotions are high, they tap into an older part still, that reptilian, in the evolutionary sense, it was there at the beginning. It's responsible for fight-flight responses. So emotions often are mediated by the mid-levels. And where emotions are very strong, hormones, chemicals get injected into the brain and you trigger the fight-flight response. You know what I mean by fight-flight? You can shut down temporarily access to the neocortex. So that what that means is that if you're a lawyer and you're wanting to interact with someone who's stressed, or if you are, you can't engage in the same way in what you need to engage with. So law interactions is a cognitive process. You need people to be interacting with you at the level of logic and reasoning to a certain degree. If they're in the fight-flight response, so experiencing a fight-flight like anger and sadness and anxiety, their capacity, their physical capacity to join with you in thinking is impeded for a while. They can't be the logical and reasoning person you might need them to be for a while. The good thing about that 20,000 years ago was that it saved people's lives. Not so adaptive now in modern place workplaces and courtrooms. But the good thing about it is that it is designed to be temporary. So when emotions express just enough, all the chemicals go back down and you can re-access the thinking parts of the brain. So what that means for us is that when there's a high emotion, we need to step back a bit and allow that process to take its course. We need to do things to not escalate the fight-flight response, possibly not provoke it. And if it has occurred, you're looking to step back a bit to allow the brain to regulate itself a bit. So what to do when you have the fight-flight, or there's a risk that what you're about to say to someone will cause them anxiety or sadness or anger? So you can sort of anticipate this in the message. And often I see this, and when I'm working with people, it's often in disciplinary practices or giving feedback to co-workers is what often there's a risk of this. So if you're wanting to say something to someone which is likely to possibly generate a defensive reaction, to depersonalise the language, so you don't talk about them as people, you talk about the behaviour you've observed. So you were late, it's not that you were lazy, you were late this day and yesterday and the day before. You don't care about your work. Well, instead of saying you don't care, you're talking about you missed a few things. So you try to make it depersonalised, not about them as a person, or you talk about the issue. Using I statements rather than you. So I have observed, I feel, I think. I statements takes the threat out of it. Interestingly, if you're giving feedback and wanting to change behaviour, avoiding the use of don'ts, I should remember this with my children. To say don't causes a recency effect. It almost primes you to do the very thing you're told not to. So if I say don't think of a pink elephant, it's the first thing you've all thought about. Got a lovely picture of a big pink elephant. It primes you to think of the very thing. So it's often a useful technique to use recency effect to your advantage. So you talk about what you want someone to do. You describe the behaviour you want to see. It's more likely to prime them to do what you want them to do. Eye contact can be used strategically. I think in micro skills counselling or micro skills listening, you're told to maintain eye contact. You're told that. Direct eye contact is a very confronting interaction. It's very intimate. And while it might be useful for listening, when you're delivering news or a message that could be potentially confronting, it can be an unnecessary reinforcement. It can lead to a more defensive reaction by its very intimacy. So other uses of eye contact you can build into interactions that are likely to generate that sort of response. They talk about the four-point communication. So to look down has been found to, if you're looking down and away, it's found to be a reflective space. Eye contact is, of course, quite intimate. A third point of communication is referring to something else, like something you're looking at in common. So often an example of that would be if you want to talk to someone about their behaviour, you use a piece of paper or a PowerPoint or something you both refer to as a third point. And the fourth point of communication is to look into the distance, which is useful or generates thoughts of future steps or people not there. So you can use those points of communication that if you want to give bad news, you might use the intimate form of the eye contact to tell them that you need to speak to them about a behaviour that they engaged in last week that you're concerned about. It wasn't very good. Can you look at this letter, that there was mistakes all through, third point of communication? And what I need to see in the future is that doesn't happen again. Can you understand that? Do you see how you can use those to take a little bit of the threat out of the message? If you eyeballed someone for that entire communication, you could say the same words, but there's a risk that they'd be looking at you, but their fight flight's gone and they haven't heard a thing you've said. And you would never know. So strategic use of eye contact can be a useful technique. Similarly with body language. Body language can generate a fight-flight response in itself. Hands up, so open hands is builds rapport and is a safe gesture. This is culturally specific a lot of the time, but I think we're reasonably safe in the legal world. Hands up is seen as non-threatening. And you might have heard the voice can lilt up at the end to build rapport. That's use of voice in a way that's non-threatening. If you want to be more authoritative and want to reinforce a message with more of that command and aggression, hands down at the table or on your hips, much more aggressive, and having eye contact, aggressive. And if you've ever heard Barack Obama speak, he speaks in a very authoritative way. Everything he says at the end of every sentence goes down. So you can use that to reinforce what you want to say or to take the threat out of your message, to be strategic about your use of body language and what happens with the tone of your voice. Just bring your attention to that sort of stuff. Okay, let's say you've done everything you can, but there has been anger displayed or sadness, which some people I find very difficult. Remember, if anyone experiences any emotion, it's theirs, not yours. Sometimes we get caught up in how people feel. Emotion, any sort of emotion is generated from the way people perceive events, so what they tell themselves about events, and that generates an emotion. If there's anger, it doesn't mean you need to be angry back. If there's sadness, you don't have to feel sad. You can be empathetic and you can be respectful without joining in the emotion. The use of silence is a very powerful technique when faced with anger and faced with sadness for that matter, to shut down all verbal, paraverbal, non-verbal cues in the face of anger. So to go blank can give a relationship time out and allow people to reconnect with the neocortex, to allow the anger to take its course. So shutting down in face of anger rather than engaging with it can be a useful technique, particularly strong anger. Silence can play its part too. You can just remain silent. You don't need to respond verbally to what's being directed your way. Always being calm and respectful, whether it's emotion or whether it's anger or sadness, is an effective technique and appropriate professionally as a lawyer. In the case of anger, in this case of sadness, you do have a core message to deliver. If you're focused on what that message is in an assertive way, in a calm, respectful, assertive way, you don't have to back away from your message in the face of anger or sadness. You might change tact a bit, but remember that the message is there to be delivered and it's okay to see it through in a firm way. Keeping your volume and your tone underneath the person you're speaking to can de-escalate a situation, so to be conscious you don't match their tone so that it just gets higher and higher and higher. And minimising the body language threat, so you might sit if they're standing. You might make sure your palms go down rather than down, so you're trying to minimise any sort of threat in the way you're presenting. In the case of sadness, I think a lot more people are sad with find the sadness harder because they're uncomfortable with how they feel in that moment, not necessarily with the expression of the emotion. They feel they don't know what to do. People are crying, they're about to lose control, and there's an internal panic that can go on. Just to recognise that might be happening in you, remember it's their feeling. You can be empathetic, you can be respectful, but you don't need to engage in the same feeling as someone else. So to offer tissues, very practical, a cup of tea. But make sure you are doing that not to manage your own discomfort, but to help them connect with their neocortex, express their feeling, have some space. Empathising and validating how they feel, saying you understand it, trying to see the world from their perspective. Okay, this is the first 60-second pause that I spoke about. So if you can turn to your thought partner, your process partner, and just think about what we've heard so far, distractions and the emotional response. What's it reminded you of? What can you add? What do you agree with? What do you don't agree with? Cover that in 60 seconds. You get a gold star for communication. Go for it. Okay. The biggest source of communication failure, though, real communication failure in day-to-day life, when you haven't engaged in distractions, you've set up the conference room well, there's no strong emotion being expressed, what really often gets in the way of effective communication is this stuff, beliefs. The way we see the world and the assumptions we make about the way other people see it. Mostly we think they see it the same way as us. So wrong. But of course we know that cognitively. You'll sit here and go, yeah, I know that. But in the moment, so easy to forget. Many, many, many studies have shown that we tend to see what we expect to see. Okay, there's a lot of stuff on cognitive bias around this. We look for what we expect to see. Like if you're buying a new car, what do you tune into? Car yards. Any other time you drive right past them, it's suddenly seeing those waving flags because you tuned into that for that time. We're very efficient thinkers. We are pattern recognizers. That's what human beings are. That's a unique skill. And we do this. We recognize patterns so that we don't have to tune into every bit of stimulation we experience every day. We filter what we need to tune into so that we can be efficient, so we can function and move through the world efficiently. So again, a very adaptive thing that humans have evolved to do. We can fill in the gaps. For instance, can you read this? Isn't that amazing? Actually, don't think that's factually correct in terms of the content, that there hasn't been any Cambridge University study, but it's an example of what our brains are able to do. We can read this. We can fill in the gaps in what we'd normally recognise. We can even adjust the patterns to make sense of them. Random black marks. We learn to recognise faces from about 4 months, I think. We're particularly good at it. What about this one? A bit harder because it's blurrier. You see the face? Anyone see the face? Where is it? Bearded man? So even really, really splodgy things, we can create faces. My husband's got this hobby at the moment. He goes up to his farm and he gets random pieces of wood and calls them wood art and names them. And he puts them in our yard. There's one that's called the swan, you know, but it's this sort of stuff. He sees random bits of wood and he names them. It's like clouds, you know, you see the shapes in clouds because we're very good at recognising patterns. There are problems with it though, when we jump to conclusions. What number is this? What number am I representing? Three, because from when we were... Before we can remember, this is what our parents said to us, that the wiggles show us at play school. We know this. We know this is how gestures are made to represent numbers. I've said what number it is. So it helps us understand the use of this gesture to communicate a meaning to you. But what you've missed is I've communicated 111. Okay, so we can make our assumptions. Three ones, 111. We can make assumptions that lead us down the wrong path. So I might have thought I was communicating 111, but the patterns you all have would say to you, that's number three, and don't tell me otherwise. We see movement where there is none. That makes you a bit dizzy after a while. We miss vital errors that are right before our eyes. You see it? Even when I prime you to tune into mistakes, okay, I want you to watch this. So there are errors in this. I want you to test your awareness of it, okay?
Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe, who, at precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts at precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was polishing the brass in the master bedroom.
I was buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
Why, I was planting my petunias in the potting shed.
Constable, arrest Lady Smythe.
But how did you know?
Madam, as any horticulturist will tell you, one does not plant petunias until May is out. Take her away.
Sorry, madam.
It's just a matter of observation. The real question is, how observant were you?
Who spotted the few errors? Couple, how many do you think? Two, three, six?
Yeah, five or six?
Watch on.
Action.
Clearly, somebody in this room murdered Lord Smythe, who, at precisely 3:34 this afternoon, was brutally bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument. I want each of you to tell me your whereabouts at precisely the time that this dastardly deed took place.
I was polishing the brass in the master bedroom.
I was buttering his lordship's scones below stairs, sir.
Why, I was planting my petunias in the potting shed.
Constable, arrest Lady Smythe.
Twenty-one changes. Because you're not looking for them, I told you were. You still get, it's hard to pick them all up. Yes. Hard to pick them all up. And we get seduced into a narrative. People tune into stories a bit more. It's another version of a cognitive filter. It's hard to tune into every piece of information so that you can accurately perceive what is out there in the world. And the same will be the case for people you're communicating with. You might want them to pick up all the important bits, what you think's important in what you're saying, but they won't. They'll tune into bits that are relevant to them. They'll tune into what they're paying attention to. They'll interpret what they tune into in a different way than what you'd expect. So what do you do? What do you do to minimise it? You're wanting to be as clear as possible, basically. You're wanting to minimise the necessity of someone having to pick up or fill in gaps for you, to make patterns in what you're saying. One rule of thumb is a good relationship means good communication. It sounds like some martial arts training, doesn't it? Good communication. If you're in good relationship with someone, usually you've done groundwork in finding common language. You're probably not even aware of it. Common ground, goodwill. This all facilitates the communication process. So you're probably getting feedback that you're not even aware of. So if you want to or you need to communicate with someone effectively, whether it be a colleague or a client, invest in forming a strong relationship with that person. You don't have to do all these micro skills or think about it so much because it comes much more easily to you on a day-to-day basis. Core message. If you have five things to say, do you need to say them all at once? Maybe one thing at a time so they can tune into that and really pay attention to that rather than be distracted by the first thing you say and not listen to the third, fourth and fifth thing you say. Keeping it simple. This is why one of the reasons why we use plain English. Is if we use it English that is in the common tongue that we all share, there's less likelihood of people having to guess at meanings and fill it in for themselves. So you use plain English so that you use language that's common to both of you as much as possible. Highly colourful, unusual, emotional trigger words. It can be very entertaining for us and we might feel very witty for using them, but it does invite the greater chance of people reacting to those words. So using simple language when you need to communicate an important message. Clear, concise, as few words as possible. Where possible, using the receiver's exact words or phrases or terminology can be a useful way. So a useful way of making sure the communication takes place. facts and then conclusions you draw from them so they can see the reasoning process you've gone down, so you're leading them through a reasoning process is an effective technique. Multiple channels. I was doing a change management intervention, and the rule of thumb was the bigger the change, the bigger the message, which means that you don't communicate a big message that's likely to generate emotional responses once. And you don't just say it verbally, you say it again in writing, you say it again in in a big group, you say it again one-to-one. So the bigger the message, bigger the number of times, the more the number of times and ways you communicate it. So we probably do this a lot. You might give a verbal advice, then you confirm it in writing. It's a good technique. You might not know why you do that, but it's good because it reinforces the message and it reduces the risk of a communication error if they weren't completely paying attention. The same can be used for communication between colleagues to confirm in writing how you've understood or what you meant to say. So there's another chance for them to give feedback if they've misunderstood what you've said. An email. Where we overuse email. Most communication, 10% of communication, I think, is the words. And so email is just 10% of the richness of communication that we pay attention to. The studies have shown if you communicate words, but you say it in angry way, the body language and the tone of voice trumps the actual words you use. I mean, if someone snarls something at you, you do tend to pick up anger or threat, even if they say something nice. So in email, you are cutting out 80% of the scope of communication. So to use it to communicate highly emotive things or very important things, the same with letter writing, is riskier. So perhaps if you've got a letter you need to send or an email you're sending, to follow up verbally on the phone or in person is a lot better technique practice. Okay, a 3-minute pause before break because I'm running over. So literally 3 minutes with your thought partner. Could you answer one or whatever you respond to, have a chat about how this can help you, what relevance this is for you, what it's reminded you of. I'll hold you to the 3 minutes, then we'll have a break. Thank you.